if we are coming. And Ruth Bolton has as many men as we do. Or more, thought Usher. Even prisoners have ears, and she had heard all the talk at Deepwood Mott when King Stannis and his captains were debating this march. Sir Justin had opposed it from the start, along with many of the knights and lords who had come with Stannis from the south. But the wolves insisted. Roose Bolton could not be suffered to hold Winterfell, and the Ned's girl must be rescued from the clutches of his bastard. So said Morgan Little, Brandon Norrie, Big Bucket Wall, the Flints, even the She-Bear.
100 leagues from Deepwood Mott to Winterfell, said Artus Flint, the night the argument boiled to a head in Gorbert Glover's Longhorn. 300 miles as raven flies.
A long march, a knight named Corlys Penny said.
Not so long as that, insisted Sir Godfrey, the big knight, the others called the Giant Slayer. We have come as far already. The Lord of Light will blaze a path for us.
And when we arrive before Winterfell, said Justin Massey, 2 walls with a moat between them, and the inner wall 100 feet high. Bolton will never march out to face us in the field, and we do not have the provisions to mount a siege.
Arne of Carstock will join his strength to ours, never forget, said Harwood Fell.
Moore's Umber as well. We will have as many Northmen as Lord Bolton, and the woods are thick north of the castle. We will raise siege towers, build rams, and die by the thousands, Asher thought.
We might do best to winter here, suggested Lord Peasbury.
Winter here? Big Bucket roared. How much food and fodder do you think Gorbert Glover has laid by?
Then Sir Richard Hope, the knight with a ravaged face and the death's head muffs on his surcoat, turned to Stannis and said,
Your Grace, your brother.
The king cut him off.
We all know what my brother would do. Robert would gallop up to the gates of Winterfell alone, break them with his war hammer, and ride through the rubble to slay Roose Bolton with his left hand and the bastard with his right.
Stannis rose to his feet.
I am not Robert, but we will march, and we will free Winterfell, or die in the attempt.
Whatever doubts his lords might nurse, the common men seemed to have faith in their king. Stannis had smashed Manse Raider's wildlings at the wall, and cleaned Asher and her ironborn out of Deepwood Mott. He was Robert's brother, victor in a famous sea battle or Fair Isle, the man who had held Storm's End all through Robert's rebellion. And he bore a hero's sword, the enchanted blade Lightbringer, whose glow lit up the night.
Our foes are not as formidable as they appear, Sir Justin assured Asher on the first day of the march. Roose Bolton is feared but little loved, and his friends, the Fays, the North has not forgotten the Red Wedding. Every lord at Winterfell lost kinsmen there. Stannis need only bloody Bolton, and the Northmen will abandon him.
So you hope, thought Usher. But first the king must bloody him. Only a fool deserts the winning side.
Sir Justin called upon her cart 6 times that first day, to bring her food and drink and tidings of the march. A man of easy smiles and endless japes, large and well-fleshed, with pink cheeks, blue eyes, and a wind-tossed tangle of white blonde hair as pale as flax. He was a considerate jailer, ever solicitous of his captive's comfort.
"He wants you," said the She-Bear, after his third visit.
Her proper name was Alisane of House Mormont, but she wore the other name as easily as she wore her mail, short, chunky, muscular. The heir to Bear Island had big thighs, big breasts, and big hands ridged with callus. Even in sleep, she wore ringmail under her furs, boiled leather under that, and an old sheepskin under the leather, turned inside out for warmth. All those layers made her look almost as wide as she was tall.
And ferocious.
Sometimes it was hard for Asher Greyjoy to remember that she and the she-bear were almost of an age.
"He wants my lands,"
Asher replied.
"He wants the Iron Islands."
She knew the signs. She had seen the same before in other suitors. Messi's own ancestral holdings, far to the south, were lost to him. So he must needs make an advantageous marriage or resign himself to being no more than a knight of the king's household. Stannis had frustrated Sir Justin's hopes of marrying the wildling princess that Asher had heard so much of. So now he had set his sights on her. No doubt he dreamed of putting her in the sea stone chair on Pike and ruling through her as her lord and master. That would require ridding her of her present lord and master, to be sure, not to mention the uncle who had married her to him.
Not likely, Asher judged. The crow's eye could eat Sir Justin to break his fast, and never even belch.
It made no matter. Her father's lands would never be hers, no matter whom she married. The Ironborn were not a forgiving people, and Asher had been defeated twice. Once at the King's Moot by her uncle Euron, and again at Deepwood Mott by Stannis. More than enough to stamp her as unfit to rule. Wedding Justin Massey, or any of Stannis Baratheon's lordlings, would hurt more than it helped.
The Kraken's daughter turned out to be just a woman after all,
the captains and the kings would say.
See how she spreads her legs for this soft-green landlord.
Still, if Sir Justin wished to court her favour with food and wine and words, Asher was not like to discourage him. He made for better company than the taciturn she-bear, and she was elsewise alone amongst 5,000 foes. Triss Botley, Carl the Maid, Crum, Rogan, and the rest of her blooded band had been left behind at Deepwood Mott in Gorbert Glover's dungeons. The army covered 22 miles the first day, by the reckoning of the guides Lady Sibel had given them, trackers and hunters sworn to Deepwood with clan names like Forrester and Woods, Branch and Bowl. The second day the host made 24, as their vanguard passed beyond the Glover lands into the thick of the Wolfswood.
"Rilor, send your light to lead us through this gloom,"
the faithful prayed that night as they gathered about a roaring blaze outside the king's pavilion. Southern knights and men-at-arms, the lot of them. Asher would have called them kingsmen, but the other Stormlanders and Crownland's men named them queensmen, though the queen they followed was the Red One at Castle Black, not the wife that Stannis Baratheon had left behind at Eastwatch by the sea.
O Lord of Light, we beseech you, cast your fiery eye upon us and keep us safe and warm, they sang to the flames, for the night is dark and full of terrors.
A big knight named Sir Godfrey Fairing led them.
Godfrey the Giant Slayer, a big name for a small man.
Fairing was broad-chested and well-muscled under his plate and mail. He was also arrogant and vain, it seemed to Asher, hungry for glory, deaf to caution, a glutton for praise, and contemptuous of small folk, wolves, and women. In the last, he was not unlike his king.
"Let me have a horse," Asher asked Sir Justin, when he rode up to the wain with half a ham. "I'm going mad in these chains. I will not attempt escape. You have my word on that."
"Would that I could, my lady. You are the king's captive, not mine own."
"Your king will not take a woman's word,"
the she-bear growled.
"Why should we trust the word of any iron man after what your brother did at Winterfell?"
"I am not Theon,"
Asher insisted, but the chains remained. As Sir Justin galloped down the column, she found herself remembering the last time she had seen her mother. It had been on Harlaw, at 10 Towers. A candle had been flickering in her mother's chamber, but her great carved bed was empty beneath its dusty canopy. Lady Alanis sat beside a window, staring out across the sea.
"Did you bring my baby boy?"
she'd asked, mouth trembling.
"Theon could not come,"
Asher had told her, looking down upon the ruin of the woman who had given her birth, a mother who had lost 2 of her sons, and a 3rd.
"I send you each a piece of prince."
Whatever befell when battle was joined at Winterfell, Asher Greyjoy did not think her brother likely to survive it.
"Theon Turncloak, even the she-bear, wants his head on a spake." "Do you have brothers?"
Asher asked her keeper. "Sisters," Alisane Mormont replied, gruff as ever. 5 we were, all girls. Lyanna is back on Bear Island. Lyra and Jory are with our mother. Daisy was murdered."
"The Red Wedding?"
"Aye." Alisane stared at Asher for a moment. "I have a son. He's only 2. My daughter's 9.
"You started young."
"Too young, but better that than wait too late."
"A stab at me," Asher thought. "But let it be. You are wed."
"No, my children were fathered by a bear." Alison smiled. Her teeth were crooked, but there was something ingratiating about that smile. "Mormont women are skin changers. We turn into bears and find mates in the woods. Everyone knows."
Asher smiled back. "Mormont women are all fighters, too."
The other woman's smile faded. "What we are is what you made us. On Bear Island, every child learns to fear krakens rising from the sea."
"The old way."
Asher turned away, chains clinking faintly. On the 3rd day, the forest pressed close around them, and the rutted roads dwindled down to game trails that soon proved to be too narrow for their larger wagons. Here and there they wound their way past familiar landmarks, a stony hill that looked a bit like a wolf's head when seen from a certain angle, a half-frozen waterfall, a natural stone arch bearded with grey-green moss. Asher knew them all. She had come this way before, riding to Winterfell to persuade her brother Theon to abandon his conquest and return with her to the safety of Deepwood Mott.
"I failed in that as well."
That day they made 14 miles, and were glad of it. When dusk fell, the driver pulled the wain off under the tree. As he was loosing the horses from the traces, Sir Justin trotted up and undid the fetters around Asher's ankles. He and the she-bear escorted her through the camp to the king's tent. A captive she might be, but she was still a Greyjoy of Pike, and it pierced Stannis Baratheon to feed her scraps from his own table, where he supped with his captains and commanders. The king's pavilion was ne'er as large as the long hall back at Deepwood Mott, but there was little grand about it beyond its size. Its stiff walls of heavy yellow canvas were badly faded, stained by mud and water, with spots of mildew showing. Atop its centre pole flew the royal standard, golden, with a stag's head within a burning heart. On 3 sides the pavilions of the southern lordlings, who had come north with Stannis, surrounded it. On the 4th side the night fire roared, lashing at the darkening sky with swirls of flame. A 12 men were splitting lugs to feed the blaze when Asher came limping up with her keepers.
"Queen's men."
Their guard was Red Relore, and a jealous guard he was. Her own guard, the drowned guard of the Iron Isles, was a demon to their eyes. And if she did not embrace this Lord of Light, she would be damned and doomed. they would as gladly burn me as those logs and broken branches.
Some had urged that very thing within her hearing after the battle in the woods. Stannis had refused. The king stood outside his tent, staring into the night fire.
What does he see there? Victory? Doom? The face of his red and hungry god?
His eyes were sunk in deep pits, his close-cropped beard no more than a shadow across his hollow cheeks and bony jawbone. Yet there was power in his stare, an iron ferocity that told Asher this man would never, ever turn back from his course. She went to one knee before him.
"Sire, am I humbled enough for you, your grace? Am I beaten, bowed, and broken sufficiently for your liking?
Strike these chains from my wrists, I beg you. Let me ride. I will attempt no escape." Stannis looked at her as he might look at a dog who presumed to hump against his leg. "You earned those irons."
"I did. Now I offer you my men, my ships, my wits."
"Your ships are mine, or burnt. Your men, how many are left? 10, 12?
9, 6, if you count only those strong enough to fight. Dagmar Cleftjaw holds Turin Square, a fierce fighter and a leal servant of House Greyjoy. I can deliver that castle to you and its garrison as well."
"Perhaps," she might have added, but it would not serve her cause to show Dot before this king. "Torrion Square is not worth a mud beneath my heels. It is Winterfell that matters."
"Strike off these irons and let me help you take it, sire. Your grace's royal brother was renowned for turning fallen foes into friends. Make me your man."
"The guards do not make you a man. How can I?" Stannis turned back to the Nightfire, and whatever he saw dancing there amongst the orange flames. Sir Justin Massey grasped Asher by the arm and pulled her inside the royal tent.
"That was ill-judged, my lady," he told her. "Never speak to him of Robert."
"I should have known better." Asher knew how it went with little brothers. She remembered Theon as a boy, a shy child who lived in awe and fear of Roderick and Maron.
"They never grow out of it," she decided. "A little brother may live to be 100, but he will always be a little brother."
She rattled her iron jewelry, and imagined how pleasant it would be to step up behind Stannis and throttle him with the chain that bound her wrists. They supped that night on a venison stew, made from a scrawny heart that a scout called Benjicott Branch had brought down. But only in the royal tent. Beyond those canvas walls, each man got a heel of bread and a chunk of black sausage no longer than a finger, washed down with the last of Gorbert Glover's ale. 100 leagues from Deepwood Mott to Winterfell. 300 miles as the raven flies. "Would that we were ravens," Justin Massey said, on the fourth day of the march, the day the snow began to fall. Only a few small flurries at first, cold and wet, but nothing they could not push through easily. But it snowed again, the next day, and the day after, and the day after that. The thick beards of the wolves were soon caked with ice, where their breath had frozen, and every clean-shaven southern boy was letting his whiskers grow out to keep his face warm. Before long, the ground ahead of the column was blanketed in white, concealing stones and twisted roots and deadfalls, turning every step into an adventure. The wind picked up as well, driving the snow before it. The king's host became a column of snowmen, staggering through knee-high drifts. On the third day of snow, the king's host began to come apart. Whilst the southern knights and lordlings struggled, the men of the northern hills fared better. Their garrons were sure-footed beasts that ate less than the palfreys, and much less than the big destriers, and the men who rode them were at home in the snow. Many of the wolves donned curious footwear. Bear paws, they call them. Queer elongated things made with bent wood and leather strips. Lashed onto the bottoms of their boots, the things somehow allowed them to walk on top of the snow without breaking through the crust and sinking down to their thighs. Some had bear paws for their horses, too, and the shaggy little garrons wore them as easily as other mounts wore iron horseshoes. But the palfreys and destriers wanted no part of them. When a few of the king's knights strapped them onto their feet nonetheless, the big southern horses balked and refused to move, or tried to shake the things off their feet. One destrier broke an ankle, trying to walk in them. The northmen on their bear paws soon began to outdistance the rest of the host. They overtook the knights in the main column, then Sir Godfrey Fairing and his vanguard, and meanwhile the wains and wagons of the baggage train were falling farther and farther behind, so much so that the men of the rear guard were constantly chivying them to keep up a faster pace. On the fifth day of the storm, the baggage train crossed a rippling expanse of waist-high snowdrifts that concealed a frozen pond. When the hidden ice cracked beneath the weight of the wagons, three teamsters and four horses were swallowed up by the freezing water, along with two of the men who tried to rescue them. One was Harwood Fell. His knights pulled him out before he drowned, but not before his lips turned blue and his skin as pale as milk. Nothing they did could seem to warm him afterwards. He shivered violently for hours, even when they cut him out of his sodden clothes, wrapped him in warm furs, and set him by the fire. That same night, he slipped into a feverish sleep. He never woke. That was the night that Asher first heard the Queen's men muttering about a sacrifice, an offering to their Red Guard, so he might end the storm. "The guards of the North have unleashed this storm on us," Sir Corlys Penny said. "False gods," insisted Sir Godfrey, the giant slayer. "Rilor is with us," said Sir Clayton Suggs.
"Melisandre is not," said Justin Massey.
The king said nothing, but he heard. Asher was certain of that. He sat at the high table as a dish of onion soup cooled before him, hardly tasted, staring at the flame of the nearest candle with those hooded eyes, ignoring the talk around him. The second in command, the lean, tall knight named Richard Hope, spoke for him.
"The storm must break soon," he declared.
But the storm only worsened. The wind became a lash as cruel as any slaver's whip. Asher thought she had known cold on Pike when the wind came howling off the sea, but that was nothing compared to this.
"This is a cold that drives men mad."
Even when the shout came down the line to make camp for the night, it was no easy thing to warm yourself. The tents were damp and heavy, hard to raise, harder to take down, and prone to sudden collapse if too much snow accumulated on top of them. The king's host was creeping through the heart of the largest forest in the Seven Kingdoms. Yet dry wood became difficult to find. Every camp saw fewer fires burning, and those that were lit threw off more smoke than heat. Oft as not, food was eaten cold, even raw. Even the night fire shrank and grew feeble, to the dismay of the queen's men.
"Lord of light, preserve us from this evil," they prayed, led by the deep voice of Sir Godfrey the giant slayer. "Show us your bright sun again. Still these winds and melt these snows, that we may reach your foes and smite them, The night is dark and cold and full of terrors, but yours is the power and glory and the light. R'lyeh, fill us with your fire.
Later, when Sir Corlys Penny wondered aloud whether an entire army had ever frozen to death in a winter storm, the wolves laughed.
"This is no winter," declared Big Bucket Wall. "Up in the hills, we say that autumn kisses you, but winter fucks you hard. This is only autumn's kiss."
"God grant that I never know true winter, then."
Asher herself was spared the worst of it. She was the king's prize, after all. Whilst others hungered, she was fed. Whilst others shivered, she was warm. Whilst others struggled through the snows atop weary horses, she rode upon a bed of furs inside a wain, with a stiff canvas roof to keep the snow off, comfortable in her chains. The horses and the common men had it hardest. Two squires from the Stormlands stabbed a man-at-arms to death in a quarrel over who would sit closest to the fire. The next night, some archers, desperate for warmth, somehow managed to set their tent afire, which had at least the virtue of heating the adjacent tents. Destriers began to perish of exhaustion and exposure. "What is a knight without a horse?" men riddled. "A snowman with a sword." Any horse that went down was butchered on the spot for meat. Their provisions had begun to run low as well. Peasbury, Cobb, Foxglove, and other southern lords urged the king to make camp until the storm had passed. Stannis would have none of that. Nor would he heed the queen's men when they came to urge him to make an offering to their hungry red god. That tale she had from Justin Massey, who was less devout than most.
"A sacrifice will prove our faith still burns true, sire,"
Clayton Suggs had told the king. And Gudry, the giant slayer, said,
"The old gods of the north have sent this storm upon us. Only R'lyeh can end it. We must give him an unbeliever."
"Half my army is made up of unbelievers," Stannis had replied.
"I will have no burnings. Pray harder."
"No burnings today, and none tomorrow. But if the snows continue, how long before the king's resolve begins to weaken?"
Asher had never shared her uncle Aaron's faith in the drowned god. But that night she prayed as fervently to he who dwells beneath the waves as ever the damp hair had. The storm did not abate. The march continued, slowing to a stagger, then a crawl. 5 miles was a good day, then three, then two. By the ninth day of the storm, every camp saw the captains and commanders entering the king's tent, wet and weary, to sink to one knee and report their losses for the day.
"One man dead, 3 missing. 6 horses lost, 1 of them mine own. 2 dead men, 1 a night. 4 horses down. We got one up again. The others are lost. Destriers and 1 palfrey."
"The Cold Count," Asher heard it named. The baggage train suffered the worst. Dead horses, lost men, wains overturned and broken. "The horses founder in the snow," Justin Massey told the king. "Men wander off or just sit down to die."
"Let them," King Stannis snapped. "We press on."
The Northmen fared much better, with their garrons and their bear paws. Black Donald Flint and his half-brother Artus only lost 1 man between them. The Liddles, the Walls, and the Norries lost none at all. One of Morgan Liddle's mules had gone astray, but he seemed to think the Flints had stolen him.
100 leagues from Deepwood Mott to Winterfell, 300 miles as a raven flies. 15 days.
The 15th day of the march came and went, and they had crossed less than half the distance. a trail of broken wains and frozen corpses stretched back behind them, buried beneath the blowing snow. The sun and moon and stars had been gone so long that Asher was starting to wonder whether she had dreamed them. It was the 20th day of the advance when she finally won free of her ankle chains. Late that afternoon, one of the horses drawing her wain died in the traces. No replacement could be found. What draft horses remained were needed to pull the wagons that held their food and fodder. When Sir Justin Massey rode up, he told them to butcher the dead horse for meat and break up the wagon for firewood. Then he removed the fetters from around Asher's ankles, rubbing the stiffness from her calves. "I have no mount to give you, my lady," he said. "And if we tried to ride double, it would be the end of my horse as well. You must walk." Asher's ankle throbbed beneath her weight with every step. "The cold will numb it soon enough," she told herself. "In an hour I won't feel my feet at all." She was only part wrong. It took less time than that. By the time darkness halted the column, she was stumbling and yearning for the comforts of her rolling prison. "The irons made me weak." Supper found her so exhausted that she fell asleep at the table. On the 26th day of the 15-day march, the last of the vegetables was consumed. On the 32nd day, the last of the grain and fodder. Asher wondered how long a man could live on raw, half-frozen horse meat. "Branchwares were only 3 days from Winterfell," Sir Richard Hope told the king that night after the cold count. "If we leave the weakest men behind," said Corliss Penny. "The weakest men are beyond saving," insisted Hope. "Those still strong enough must reach Winterfell, or die as well."
"The Lord of Light will deliver us the castle," said Sir Godfrey Fairing, "if Lady Melisandre were with us."
Finally, after a nightmarish day, when the column advanced a bare mile and lost 12 horses and 4 men, Lord Peasbury turned against the Northmen.
"This march was madness. More dying every day, and for what? Some girl?"
"Ned's girl," said Morgan Little. He was the second of 3 sons. So the other wolves called him Middle Little, though not often in his hearing. It was Morgan who had almost slain Asher in the fight by Deepwood Mott. He had come to her later, on the march, to beg her pardon for calling her cunt in his battle lust, not for trying to split her head open with an axe.
"Ned's girl," echoed Big Bucket Wall. "And we should have had her and the castle both, if you prancing Southland jackanapes didn't piss your satin breeches at Little Snow."
"A little snow?" Peasbury's soft, girlish mouth twisted in fury. "Your ill counsel forced this march upon us, well. I am starting to suspect that you have been Bolton's creature all along. Is that the way of it? Did he send you to us to whisper poison in the king's ear?" Big Bucket laughed in his face.
"Lord Peabod, if you were a man, I would kill you for that. But my sword is made of too fine a steel to besmirch with craven's blood."
He took a drink of ale and wiped his mouth.
"Aye, men are dying. More will die before we see Winterfell. What of it? This is war. Men die in war. That is as it should be, as it has always been."
Sir Corliss Penny gave the clan chief an incredulous look.
"Do you want to die, Wall?"
That seemed to amuse the Northman.
"I want to live forever, in a land where summer lasts 1,000 years. I want a castle in the clouds, where I can look down over the world. I want to be 26 again. When I was 26, I could fight all day and fuck all night. What men want does not matter. Winter is almost upon us, boy, and winter is death. I would sooner my men die fighting for the Ned's little girl than alone and hungry in the snow, weeping tears that freeze upon their cheeks. No one sings songs of men who die like that. As for me, I'm old. This will be my last winter. Let me bathe in Bolton blood before I die. I want to feel it spatter across my face when my axe bites deep into a Bolton skull. I want to lick it off my lips and die with the taste of it on my tongue.
"Aye," shouted Morgan Little, "blood and battle." Then all the hillmen were shouting, banging their cups and drinking horns on the table, filling the king's tent with the clangor. Asher Greyjoy would have welcomed a fight herself.
"One battle to put an end to this misery. Steel on steel, pink snow, broken shields, and severed limbs, and it would all be done."
The next day the king's scouts chanced upon an abandoned crofter's village between two lakes, a mean and meagre place, no more than a few huts, a long hall, and a watchtower. Richard Hawp commanded a halt, though the army had advanced no more than a half mile that day, and they were hours shy of dark. It was well past moonrise before the baggage train and rear guard straggled in. Asher was amongst them.
"There are fish in those lakes," Hawp told the king. "We'll cut holes in the ice. The Northmen know how it's done."
Even in his bulky fur cloak and heavy armour, Stannis looked like a man with one foot in the grave. What little flesh he'd carried on his tall, spare frame at Deepwood Mott had melted away during the march. The shape of his skull could be seen under his skin, and his jaw was clenched so hard Asher feared his teeth might shatter. "Fish, then," he said, biting off each word with a snap. "But we march at first light." Yet when light came, the camp woke to snow and silence. The sky turned from black to white, and seemed no brighter. Asher Greyjoy awoke cramped and cold, beneath a pile of sleeping furs, listening to the she-bear snores. She had never known a woman snore so loudly, but she had grown used to it whilst on the march, and even took some comfort in it now. It was the silence that troubled her. No trumpets blew to rouse the men to mount up, form column, prepare to march. No war horns summoned forth the Northmen. "Something is wrong." Asher called out from under her sleeping furs and pushed her way out of the tent, knocking aside the wall of snow that had sealed them in during the night. Her irons clanked as she climbed to her feet and took a breath of the icy morning air. The snow was still falling, even more heavily than when she had crawled inside the tent. The lakes had vanished, and the woods as well. She could see the shapes of other tents and lean-tos and the fuzzy orange glow of the beacon fire burning atop the watchtower, but not the tower itself. The storm had swallowed the rest. Somewhere ahead, Roose Bolton awaited them, behind the walls of Winterfell. But Stannis Baratheon's host sat snowbound and unmoving, walled in by ice and snow, starving. Daenerys. The candle was almost gone. Less than an inch remained, jutting from a pool of warm melted wax to cast its light over the queen's bed. The flame had begun to gutter.
"It will go out before much longer," Danny realized, "and when it does, another night will be at its end."
Dawn always came too soon. She had not slept, could not sleep, would not sleep. She had not even dared to close her eyes, for fear it would be morning when she opened them again. If only she had the power, she would have made their nights go on forever,
but the best that she could do was stay awake, to try and savour every last sweet moment before daybreak turned them into no more than fading memories. Beside her, Dario Naharis was sleeping as peacefully as a newborn babe. He had a gift for sleeping, he'd boasted, smiling in that cocksure way of his. In the field, he would sleep in the saddle oft as not, he claimed, so as to be well rested should he come upon a battle. Sun or storm, it made no matter. "A warrior who cannot sleep soon has no strength to fight," he said. He was never vexed by nightmares either. When Danny told him how Serwyn of the Mirror Shield was haunted by the ghosts of all the knights he'd killed, Dario only laughed. "If the ones I killed come bother me, I will kill them all again."
"He has a sailsword's conscience," she realized then. "That is to say, none at all."
Dario lay upon his stomach, the light linen coverlets tangled about his long legs, his face half buried in the pillows. Danny ran her hand down his back, tracing the line of his spine. His skin was smooth beneath her touch, almost hairless.
"His skin is silk and satin."
She loved the feel of him beneath her fingers. She loved to run her fingers through his hair, to knead the ache from his calves after a long day in the saddle, to cup his cock and feel it harden against her palm. If she had been some ordinary woman, she would gladly have spent her whole life touching Dario, tracing his scars and making him tell her how he'd come by every one.
"I would give up my crown if he asked it of me," Danny thought.
But he had not asked it, and never would. Dario might whisper words of love when the two of them were as one, but she knew it was the Dragon Queen he loved.
"If I gave up my crown, he would not want me."
Besides, kings who lost their crowns oft lost their heads as well, and she could see no reason why it would be any different for a queen. The candle flickered one last time and died, drowned in its own wax. Darkness swallowed the feather bed and its two occupants, and filled every corner of the chamber. Danny wrapped her arms around her captain and pressed herself against his back. She drank in the scent of him, savoring the warmth of his flesh, the feel of his skin against her own.
"Remember," she told herself, "remember how he felt."
She kissed him on his shoulder. Dario rolled toward her, his eyes open.
"Daenerys."
He smiled a lazy smile. That was another of his talents. He woke all at once, like a cat.
"Is it done?" "Not yet. We have a while still."
"Liar, I can see your eyes. Could I do that if it were the black of night?"
Dario kicked loose of the coverlets and sat up.
"The half-light. Day will be here soon."
"I do not want this night to end."
"No. And why is that, my queen?"
"You know."
"The wedding." He laughed. "Marry me instead."
"You know, I cannot do that."
"You are a queen. You can do what you like."
He slid a hand along her leg.
"How many nights remain to us?"
"Two. Only two. You know as well as I. This night and the next. And we must end this."
"Marry me, and we can have all the nights forever."
"If I could, I would."
Khal Drogo had been her sun and stars, but he had been dead so long that Daenerys had almost forgotten how it felt to love and be loved. Dario had helped her to remember.
"I was dead, and he brought me back to life. I was asleep, and he woke me, my brave captain."
Even so, of late he grew too bold. On the day that he had returned from his latest sortie, he had tossed the head of a Yunkish lord at her feet, and kissed her in the hall for all the world to see, until Barristan Selmy pulled the two of them apart.
Sir Grandfather had been so wroth that Danny feared blood might be shed.
"We cannot wed, my love. You know why."
He climbed from her bed.
"Marry his daughter, then. I will give him a nice set of horns for his wedding gift. Giscari men like to prance about in horns. They make them from their own hair, with combs and wax and irons."
Dario found his breeches and pulled them on. He did not trouble himself with small clothes.
"Once I am wed, it will be high treason to desire me."
Danny pulled the coverlet up over her breasts.
"Then I must be a traitor."
He slipped a blue silk tunic over his head and straightened the prongs of his beard with his fingers. He had dyed it afresh for her, taking it from purple back to blue, as it had been when first she met him.
"I smell of you,"
he said, sniffing at his fingers and grinning. Danny loved the way his gold tooth gleamed when he grinned. She loved the fine hairs on his chest. She loved the strength in his arms, the sound of his laughter, the way he would always look into her eyes and say her name as he slid his cock inside her.
"You are beautiful,"
she blurted, as she watched him don his riding boots and lace them up. Some days he let her do that for him, but not today, it seemed.
"That's done with, too."
"Not beautiful enough to marry." Dario took his sword belt off the peg where he had hung it.
"Where are you going?"
"Out into your city," he said, "to drink a keg or two and pick a quarrel. It's been too long since I've killed a man. Might be I should seek out your betrothed."
Danny threw a pillow at him.
"You will leave his dart be."
"As my queen commands. Will you hold court today?"
"No, on the morrow I will be a woman wed, and his star will be king. Let him hold court. These are his people."
"Some are his, some are yours. The ones you freed."
"Are you chiding me?"
"The ones you call your children. They want their mother."
You are chiding me."
"Only a little, Brightheart. Will you come hold court?"
"After my wedding, perhaps. After the peace."
"This after that you speak of never comes. You should hold court. My new men do not believe that you are real. The ones who came over from the windblown, bred and born in Westeros, most of them, full of tales about Targaryens. They want to see one with their own eyes. The frog has a gift for you."
"The frog," she said, giggling. "And who is he?"
He shrugged. "Some Dornish boy. He squires for the big knight they call Green Guts. I told him he could give his gift to me and I'd deliver it, but he wouldn't have it."
"Oh, a clever frog. Give the gift to me."
She threw the other pillow at him.
"Would I have ever seen it?"
Dario stroked his gilded mustachio.
"Would I steal from my sweet queen? If it were a gift worthy of you, I would have put it into your soft hands myself."
"As a token of your love?"
"As to that, I will not say. But I told him that he could give it to you."
"You would not make a liar of Dario Naharis?"
Danny was helpless to refuse.
"As you wish, bring your frog to court tomorrow. The others, too. The Westerosi."
It would be nice to hear the common tongue from someone besides Sir Barristan.
"As my queen commands."
Dario bowed deeply, grinned, and took his leave, his cloak swirling behind him. Danny sat amongst the rumpled bedclothes with her arms about her knees. So forlorn, she did not hear when Missandei came creeping in with bread and milk and figs.
"Your Grace, are you unwell? In the black of night this one heard you scream."
Danny took a fig. It was black and plump, still moist with dew.
"Will Hestar ever make me scream?" "It was wind that you heard screaming."
She took a bite, but the fruit had lost its savour, now that Dario was gone. Sighing, she rose and called to Iri for a robe, then wandered out onto her terrace. Her furs were all about her. There were never less than a dozen ships drawn up on the shore. Some days there were as many as 100 when the soldiers were disembarking. The Yunkai were even bringing in wood by sea. Behind their ditches they were building catapults, scorpions, tall trebuchets. On still nights she could hear the hammers ringing through the warm, dry air.
No siege towers, though. No battering rams.
They would not try to take Meereen by storm. They would wait behind their siege lines, flinging stones at her until famine and disease had brought her people to their knees.
Histar will bring me peace. He must.
That night her cooks roasted her a kid with dates and carrots, but Danny could only eat a bite of it. The prospect of wrestling with Meereen once more left her feeling weary. Sleep came hard, even when Dario came back so drunk that he could hardly stand. Beneath her coverlets she tossed and turned, dreaming that Histar was kissing her, but his lips were blue and bruised, and when he thrust himself inside her, his manhood was cold as ice. She sat up with her hair dishevelled and the bedclothes tangled. Her captain slept beside her, yet she was alone. She wanted to shake him, wake him, make him hold her, fuck her, help her forget. But she knew that if she did, he would only smile and yawn and say,
"It was just a dream, my queen. Go back to sleep."
Instead, she slipped into a hooded robe and stepped out onto her terrace. She went to the parapet and stood there, gazing down upon the city, as she had done 100 times before.
"It will never be my city. It will never be my home."
The pale pink light of dawn found her still out on her terrace, asleep upon the grass beneath a blanket of fine dew.
"I promised Dario that I would hold court today," Daenerys told her handmaids when they woke her. "Help me find my crown. Oh, and some clothes to wear. Something light and cool."
She made her descent an hour later.
"All kneel for Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of Meereen, Queen of the Andals, and the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Khaleesi of Great Grass Sea, Breaker of Shackles, and Mother of Dragons," Missandei called.
Resnick Mo Resnick bowed and beamed.
"Magnificence! Every day you grow more beautiful. I think the prospect of your wedding has given you a glow, oh, my shining queen."
Danny sighed.
"Summon the first petitioner."
It had been so long that she had last held court that the crush of cases was almost overwhelming. The back of the hall was a solid press of people, and scuffles broke out over precedence. Inevitably, it was Galaza Galari who stepped forward, her head held high, her face hidden behind a shimmering green veil.
"Your Radiance, it might be best were we to speak in private." "Would that I had the time," said Danny sweetly. "I am to be wed upon the morrow."
Her last meeting with the Green Grace had not gone well.
"What would you have of me? I would speak to you about the presumption of a certain self-thought captain." "She dares say that in open court?"
Danny felt a blaze of anger.
"She has courage, I grant that. But if she thinks I'm about to suffer another scolding, she could not be more wrong." "The treachery of Brownbrain Plum has shocked us all," she said. "But your warning comes too late. And now I know you will want to return to your temple to pray for peace."
The Green Grace bowed.
"I shall pray for you as well."
Another slap, thought Danny, colour rising to her face. The rest was a tedium the queen knew well. She sat upon her cushions, listening, one foot jiggling with impatience. Jiqui brought a platter of figs and ham at midday. There seemed to be no end to the petitioners. For every two she sent off, smiling, one left red-eyed or muttering. It was close to sunset before Dario Naharis appeared with his new storm crows, the Westerosi who had come over to him from the windblown. Danny found herself glancing at them as yet another petitioner droned on and on.
"These are my people. I am their rightful queen."
They seemed a scruffy bunch, but that was only to be expected of sellswords. The youngest could not have been more than a year older than she. The elders must have seen 60 name days. A few sported signs of wealth, gold arm rings, silken tunics, silver-studded sword belts.
Plunder.
For the most part, their clothes were plainly made and showed signs of hard wear. When Dario brought them forward, she saw that one of them was a woman, big and blonde, and all in mail.
"Pretty Maris," her captain named her.
Though pretty was the last thing Danny would have called her, she was 6 feet tall and earless, with a slit nose, deep scars in both cheeks, and the coldest eyes the Queen had ever seen. As for the rest, Hugh Hungerford was slim and saturnine, long-legged, long-faced, clad in faded finery. Weber was short and muscular, with spiders tattooed across his head and chest and arms. Red-faced Orson Stone claimed to be a knight, as did lanky Lucifer Long. Will of the Woods leered at her, even as he took a knee. Dick Straw had cornflower blue eyes, hair as white as flax, and an unsettling smile. Ginger Jack's face was hidden behind a bristly orange beard, and his speech was unintelligible.
"He bit off half his tongue in his first battle," Hungerford explained to her.
The Dornishman seemed different.
"If it please your grace," said Dario, "these three are Gringotts, Geralt, and Frog."
Gringotts was huge and bald as a stone, with arms thick enough to rival even strong Belwas. Geralt was a lean, tall youth, with sun streaks in his hair and laughing blue-green eyes.
"That smile has won many a maiden's heart, I'll wager."
His cloak was made of soft brown wool lined with sand silk, a goodly garment. Frog, the squire, was the youngest of the three, and the least impressive, a solemn, stocky lad, brown of hair and eye. His face was squarish, with a high forehead, heavy jaw, and broad nose. The stubble on his cheeks and chin made him look like a boy trying to grow his first beard. Danny had no inkling why anyone would call him Frog.
"Perhaps he can jump farther than the others." "You may raise," she said. "Dario tells me you come to us from Dorn. Dornishmen will always have a welcome at my court. Sunspear stayed loyal to my father when the usurper stole his throne. You must have faced many perils to reach me."
"Too many," said Geralt, the handsome one with the sun-streaked hair. "We were six when we left Dorne, your grace."
"I am sorry for your losses."
The queen turned to his large companions.
"Gringotts is a queer sort of name."
"A jape, your grace, from the ships. I was greensick the whole way from Belantis, heaving and, well, I shouldn't say."
Danny giggled.
"I think I can guess, sir. It is sir, is it not? Dario tells me that you are a knight."
"If it please your grace, we're all three knights."
Danny glanced at Dario and saw anger flash across his face.
"He did not know." "I have need of knights," she said.
Sir Barristan's suspicions had awakened.
"Knighthood is easily claimed this far from Westeros. Are you prepared to defend that boast with sword or lance?"
"If need be," said Geralt.
though I will not claim that any of us is the equal of Barristan the Bold. Your Grace, I beg your pardon, but we have come before you under false names.